Session number 14983, Albert Shippen, Reel 5.
Mr. Shippen, Reel 5. When you went in the army as a 14-year-old, Mr. Shippen, you were obviously subjected to the normal NCOs and their swearing habits. Was this a problem?
No, the majority of the NCOs involved in people looking after the young soldiers and boy soldiers at the time were really experienced people in pre-war. And nine times out of ten, they were people from the band and the bugles. Where everyone knows that the gentlemen of the regiment were the bandsmen. And we didn't get subject to those kind of harsh words and that. But on the other hand, the being shouted at reflects in two ways. Being light infantry and being having to move at a fast pace and turn and this kind of thing and stand at ease, which is light infantry drill, the command of the words we were always taught was the executive word had to be shouted out in a loud and screaming manner, which then made you react in that acute way that they wanted you to do it. Drill was always a very important part of your training in the band and the bugles, because you've got to appreciate that nine times out of ten, the band was always at the head of any procession. And also, we used to go and give demonstrations on beat and retreat, and salute the soldiers and all this kind of thing. And I don't think there would be anything more demoralising than seeing abandoned bugles not presenting themselves the way that the public would like to have presented themselves. Very smart, efficient, well turned out, well groomed, and that was the where we had to project ourselves. But swearing was not a problem in our sections at all, but being shouted at, well, yes, and probably more so screamed at in some way. But you had to, the thing about it was you can appreciate the bandsman with his instrument in some cases. And marching at 140 paces to the minute, it was quite a hard thing for him to do and look military, where the bugler marched along with his bugle on his hip. And even when we were playing our part in the band, the bugle marches, and we could still swing our arms and this kind of thing and be very presentable at the same time. So we used to have to try and put on the bit of polish as far as military were concerned in the presentation.
How did the, in general, how did the rest of the soldiery treat you?
Oh, with reverence. I mean, you would find out that, I mean, even when I was a boy soldier, and I was on guard as a duty bugler, you would get guard commanders in who were sergeants and corporals and that were the battalion orderly, company orderly sergeants and people like that. And they would rely on your experience to tell them what was happening and how to go about things and that, and would take your word without any diffidence at all. They would just say, right, you're up, if you say that's it, that's it. And nine times out of ten, particularly with Lance Corporals and this kind of thing, I used to make the guard reports out for them and show them how to put the people on duty in the military hours, 0900, what it meant. And when they used to read the guard orders off to the sentry and that, I used to explain to them in detail before they went, so the sentry, they could explain to the sentry when they read the guard orders off to them, and this kind of thing. Oh yes, and we were very well treated by all and sundry in that. And when we used to go to the castle, be the duty bugler at the castle, and we had the officers had guests and that there, we used to blow the officers' guest call and this kind of thing. Everybody was always appreciation if you played a good bugle call. And when you were on the castle guard, at retreat at 7 o'clock when the flag came down from the tower, and you could plainly rest assured that 95% of the people in the castle headquarters would be listening to you blow that bugle call.
Were there perks to be had because you did these things at officers' messes and so forth?
Oh yes. If there was a general or something like that, and you played a good last post in the ladies, some waiter would arrive with a bottle of beer for you from the general, or some extraordinary food that from the dinner, and this kind of thing. And 9 times out of 10, the generals, when you were on the guard and you played the general salute for you, would all stop and thank you and ask you how long you'd been in and how things were going and this kind of thing. I think you very rarely got any real criticism from anybody in that respect, as long as you did your duty correctly.
Did you get leave?
Oh yes. Well, the leave pattern was more or less, as far as we were concerned, because we were on duty 24 hours, probably every 3 days, at least. And then with all the other commitments, doing the outside parades and what have we, and the morale building things and playing the football matches and so forth and that, we were given weekend leave when it was permissible. We never got more than 7 days leave at one time over the period because of the commitment, and it was quite heavy in a lot of respects regarding both the military side and the civilian side, because I suppose looking back at it now, it was a morale booster for the people in those days, 1941, 42 and that, and when things weren't too bright and this kind of thing. I suppose they used us as a front.
When you did get leave, where did you go? Did you go home?
Well, I had a military friend who lived in Poplar in London, and never been farther than York in my life, I went to with him on leave to Poplar, and also I had another friend who lived in Derby, and his family were connected in their civilian employment with the railways, and of course we went down there, and of course never been involved in the railways and all the trains and that were involved in those days, the steam trains and everything, I spent a couple of leaves with him. But one of the big dodges we had for people like me who lived locally was that the lads who lived in London, of course our pay was only 2 shillings a day. And what we used to do was put our leave address in to his address. And of course we used to get a railway warrant. which the London lads would use if they ever got a long weekend, to go down on a Friday night and be up by the Monday morning. We used to call it an honest perk.
And no one discovered what you were doing?
Well, I suppose they probably did, but it was 6 2/3. We weren't doing anything. If we wanted to go to London, we were entitled to go to London on the league pass, you see. But of course, we didn't. We used to stop at me being Lunitz anymore. I used to go to my sister's at Staindrop or somewhere like that.
You've touched upon on medicals and the medical officer keeping an eye on you as it was growing young people. How many medicals were you getting? Was it a regular thing?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had special rations. Even boys in the wartime, we had, would you believe it or not, we had, I think it was a pint of milk a day, which was unique. We were also rationed for supper. We had to, at 7 o'clock on the night, we could go and have a supper meal, which was at 10 o'clock, in the naffy break and that, we would, there would be tea and rice cakes or biscuits or something like laid on in one of the dining rooms for the boys, plus your half a pint of milk. And in the afternoon, the boys used to get half a pint of milk and biscuits. So medical and dental were, I would think, we used to do what they called FFI every Saturday morning. So you went to the gymnasium after doing the parade on the square, and that was the gymnasium period. But you went in your PT kit and that, and then before you started to do your PT kit, the medical officer came round. You had to lift your arms up to see if there was no rashes or anything under your arms, and then you all had your vest off and you pulled your shorts down, and he inspected your rear and front to see if there was no rashes or anything on there, and then we used to parade about every 2 months for dental regardless. It was a special session probably in the afternoon where you would have to go to the dental surgery and have your teeth looked at and everything.
The traditions and history of the regiment you mentioned were part of your schoolwork, and this would build up a pride in the regiment?
Oh yes, I think that one of the things about it, you know, you learned about the faithful Durhams when they were in the West Indies, how they kept the regiment going without being reinforced. You learned all about Inkerman, about how the warrant officers and sergeants took over from the officers. You learned about the 2nd Battalion at Hooge in the First World War. You learned about the sports side of the Durham Regiment as well, how they'd done famously as an infantry regiment, winning the polo challenge ships and that. You've also learned, I may add this at this point, that I polished it on numerous occasions, the Leod Trade Cup, which now stands very proudly in our museum. And that was for footballing in India against all the other units in India. And the thing was, you know, you learned what did DLI mean? And it meant devotion, loyalty, and incompatible. And those were the kind of things that stuck in your mind. And you were proud to be in the Durham Light Infantry. No matter, I've served in a number of units, and I've always been proud to have been a Durham Light Infantryman.
You mentioned some of the ceremonies outside of camp that you attended. Were there traditional regimental ceremonies which were commemorated regularly every year?
Well, we had Inkerman and Hooge, which was the 1st Battalion Battle Honour was Inkerman, the 2nd Battalion was Huljinad. But when we went outside and we did these wings for victories and so forth and that, it was more or less a presentation to the civilians. But when we went to, shall we say, Kattrick, there was a number of units down there, and shall we say, we were allocated to go and do a parade for the 10th the Tank Regiment, the Royal Artillery. Well, they would have their traditions and this kind of thing, and we would go down the day beforehand and see how much space they were going to give us and how we could do our marching and that, and then come up with a programme and then adapt ourselves to do their 110 pace down the thing. 9 times out of 10, I must agree that we would probably tell a little white lie or something, prefer to stand while they march past, and then we would then march off at our own regimental pace to Staedel ashore at the end of the day.
So, for the traditional historical parade which you celebrated each year, that would be a major parade with the whole of the Durham Light Infantry contingent on parade in the camp.
Oh yes, what they call a scalier parade. Nobody was exempt from it. And then, of course, the other thing that you used to do, and this kind of thing, we used to get contingency from the Home Guard, which was substantial in Durham County in those days, and also contingents from the cadet force that used to come along and do the parades, etc., and from the veterans as well, the DLI Association people. Yes, those were the kind of things that took place. And of course, when the footballing was on, the Army played the Air Force or something like that, we would be present there, and so would all the other kind of people. But it was very important, you know, to maintain the, what I call, keep the Army in the public eye, and even with the cathedral. People and the people in Durham City who ran the DLI Prisoners of War Fund and Comfort Funds and this kind of thing, and the ladies that used to do the knitting and hand in sweaters and balaclavas and socks and this kind of thing to go back and show our appreciation, the regiment shows their appreciation by putting them on a concert at the band and bugle, so and this kind of thing. We had quite a good choir in the band as well, which, and we had a singer that was attached to us. I would say that in, at that time, I can't recall his name just off the top of my head at the moment, but he was quite a famous singer, and he used to go around with the band singing, and they used to do broadcasts on the BBC and the, workers' playtime and that with factories. So it was quite, as I say, we were always on the move and what have we, and doing something. It was quite interesting as I look back on it now, but at the time, I think I might have said it was a bit ball-aching all the time, because we would probably get down there and stand around for hours as military people, and then do a half an hour programme and have to shuffle around and wait for our transport coming back, and God knows what, and spend the day doing a half an hour's programme.
Church parades, were they regularly for every Sunday?
Every Sunday.
What form did they take?
Well, it was, first of all, you would, we would go, we'd Blory Valley at say on a Sunday at 7 o'clock, and breakfast would be 8. Then we'd have the fall in about 9 o'clock. Well, that was an excuse for the sergeants and the sergeant majors to inspect the men, and made sure and checked the barrack rooms over again and what have we. And then they would then march the companies from the camp to the castle, which was about a quarter of a mile away, because the church they used was down in Bransford, the local church. And then the officers being stationed at the castle would then join the parade down there, and would go through it. But it was more or less a way of ensuring that the soldiers, although there was no training, they were being trained in a way by being inspected, and they had to turn out the kit to make sure it was up to standard, and that they give them marching practice again, and turning at the halt and doing what have we. And then, of course, that took up most of the Sunday morning, and then marched back and have the lunches. Then they were allowed out.
And you actually attended the church service?
Oh, yes, the band and bugles were on the church service, yes.
What happened to the men of other denominations?
Oh, yes, well, there was always an RC's thing now, but if they were the people that got barrack room duties, like looking after the orderly, things like that, washing the ablutions, and that's why nine times out of ten you had a scaly parade, everybody turned out for church parade, otherwise they got a job digging the garden or washing the ablutions up, or this kind of thing, because all those things have to be done regardless of whether it's Saturday, Sunday, Monday or Tuesday, haven't they?
It was a training centre. How often did you receive drafts of new recruits?
Every fortnight.
And how many would that likely to be?
Well, the thing about it is, and that, you see, at the beginning, you would, as the camp progressed, they would increase the number of people coming in till they built up to 3,000. But after about 43 or thereabouts, it changed over to the new system where they came in and they only did 6 weeks training, and then the personal selection office took over. And in that first 6 weeks, they were then assessed to see what arm they could go into in the forces, and also what was required to build up special units and that would be designed because of the mobility of the regiments, the more sophisticated weapons that was coming in, signalling was improving, and that. So it varied. But I think you would honestly say the majority of intakes would average round about 400 to 600 each fortnight that they came in.
It's quite a lot of men.
Oh, yes, yes, it was. You could tell when the drafts weren't going out and the recruits were coming in, because there was a tremendous build-up in all activities in the camp, from the cinemas, the cookhouses, the dining rooms, the naffies and so forth and everything like that. But the main thing was when they were called up, it was the first 3 or 4 days getting them equipped and tailored and the haircuts and the medicals and all those kind of thing.
We've mentioned briefly the ATS, which is held at a camp near you or next to you. Can you give me some details as to what they did? What was their role within the training camp situation?
Well, the roles were numerous, and there was about 600 permanent staff on the camp, and included instructors, the band and bugles, headquarters staff at the castle, and the camp, police, cooks, and training personnel, medical personnel, dental, and so forth. Of the 600 permanent staff, it was estimated that about 300 of those were the ATS girls. and they did every job imaginable. Down in the castle, they ran the officers' mess as waitresses, as cooks, as GD people washing up. There were typists, there were shorthand typists, there were switchboard operators, and drivers. Then they had their own camp to look after, where there was 300 of them built it. And then in the main camp, the majority of them worked in the cook houses and the dining rooms. And when we used to go on out to blow Reveille at 6:30, those girls were coming through the garden room gate to get the prepare the breakfasts and everything. And then at night time, as we were blowing last post, they would be going out after working in the cook houses all day long, putting up haversack rations for people, going down to Whitburn ranges to fire, people going up to stand up to throw grenades, and all the duties that had to be done there. Oh, they were a tremendous help. They worked in the sergeant's messes, they worked in the medical orderlies, they were switchboard operators, they were in the ration stores, they worked in the tailor's shop. They worked in the barber shops. They did assist in practically everything, weapon training, and of course you could just imagine the paperwork that was involved in 3,000 men and a turnover of writing out draft reports, doing men's documentation, medical documentation, and also the side of looking after people that had problems and this kind of thing. So they were fully employed, and they did a tremendous job in my eyes. And I'm sure everybody appreciated the work that they did, because when things got the rundown of NCOs and all this kind of thing. I remember on occasions where a lot of NCOs were wanted to go out to West Africa to take a unit out to Burma, and they scoured the camp for NCOs and everything like that, and took them away, and these girls filled in the gaps that was left out of the jobs that people had left behind. They were very essential part of the organisation.
They would have the same military discipline as yourselves, no doubt, and you would have to recognise their ranks, no?
Oh yes. You call their officers ma'am, and the sergeant, and the corporals, yes. I must say that, to put a bit more human side on it, we had a corporal that looked after us when we were in the castle of Abandoned Bugles. And she was more like a mother than anything else. And she used to faff over you like a mother over a brood of chickens. Very nice person and this kind of thing. But you found that amongst them, the older ones in particular. And with us being young boys and this kind of thing, I think we used to get away with a little bit more than we should have been allowed now and again.
Do you remember her name?
Ginny Lowry. Very charming woman. Nice person. And nothing was a bother to her. She would say things to you like, have you had enough to eat today, my dear? Yes, thanks, Corporal. Well, here's a treat for you. And she'd give you a bar of chocolate. And it was on ration. And things like that. And after the evening meal, she'd say, come down tonight and I'll put you something special on for your suppers. And right, well, we'd put you something special on, and we'd probably go down there and find that she'd cooked us some nice meat pies and some cakes, and made us some coffee, which was things like that, and oxos or something like that. She would always find something to do, which was a bit unique to what we had from our military rations. Nine times out of ten, she'd beg, borrowed or steal from all and sundry to do that for us.